Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Coming right up, March 7th, 2015, in Indianapolis, I'll be presenting a seminar on the evidence against the Big Bang, and I think today's program will help the audience determine whether or not the material in that seminar is scientifically informed. Is it out of date? Is it from an amateur? Or is it basic, solid science? Now, last week, we began interviewing a physicist, cosmologist from Australia, Dr. John Hartnett. What an honor to have from the University of Adelaide, the School of Physical Sciences, back with us, Dr. John Hartnett. Welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, you're very welcome. Then let's continue where we left off. John, we were going through our bullets of evidence against the Big Bang. The next one is not as fundamental, but it's so interesting to me. It's been claimed that spiral galaxies get so enormous because of mergers. And the bulge in the center of the spiral galaxies, the bulge is because of millions of years of collisions. So some very well-known cosmologists and astrophysicists, Jim Peebles from Princeton and from University of Texas, John Cormandy, they had a major study looking at the bulges of the spiral galaxies. And what they found seemed to contradict what they expected as Big Bang proponents.
Yeah, so the problem is that, again, starting with the Big Bang, these galaxies are supposed to start out in a sort of a pretty simple form, and they then say over time, by mergers, by galaxies colliding with each other and merging, that they grow their central bulge. So eventually, if you have enough of them, they should lose their spiral structure altogether and look like something like a giant elliptical, you know, some almost or spherical galaxy which has no spiral structure. But there are many spiral galaxies that have no central bulges. They even use the word pristine when they describe them.
Oh, I love...
They're like...
Yes, I love their terminology, Dr. Hartnett. In fact, Jim Peebles, who's a very well-known cosmologist, he said the results are really something of an embarrassment. And John Cormandy said that these pristine spiral galaxies, they were something of a shock, for they look rather too perfect. And boy, that is just so reminiscent of our creator God. But we do a show called Real Science Radio's List of Shocked Evolutionists, because on so many fundamental observations, the evolutionist or the secular cosmologist, they say they're shocked. And the reason they're shocked is because what they're looking at is inconsistent with their theory.
That's right. It's their worldview, right?
Yeah.
So this is, again, this is where their worldview informs of what they're looking at in the universe. And their worldview says that this just should not be so, you know. This is quite different, in fact, from the experimentalist. You know, the experimentalist comes up with a contradiction in his theory when he interacts with his experiment. He then either throws his theory out or modifies it radically because he's realized that the outcome of the experiment has shown a flaw in his model. But in cosmology, they don't. In cosmology, because the worldview is really a paradigm, must be maintained, they just act shocked and maintain the worldview.
Mm-hmm. So then, Dr. Hartnett, the fourth bullet on the list we've covered already, clusters of galaxies at great distances where the Big Bang predicts they should not exist. So perhaps we could go on then.
Okay, so the next one after that, 9 billion years of missing metal in a trillion stars.
Hmm.
Okay, I think here you're talking about the metallicity content in galaxies, the idea being that metal in stars, in astronomy speak, is just any elements that are heavier than hydrogen or heavier than helium, and maybe a little bit of lithium there might be or something like that. But most of the other elements that we might measure in stars are things like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all of those. They're referred to as metals. In the early stars, and therefore the early galaxies, the metal content should have been very, very low. Over time, as stars age, then they should accumulate, right? It should increase. Yes. And build up.
And so Dr. Hartnett, a paper in the Astrophysical Journal, points out that there are 15 spiral galaxies that should have 9 billion years of heavier elements in their stars, but they don't. And so if the entire field of stellar nucleosynthesis is accurate with the Big Bang framework of the age of the universe, then we're talking about 9 billion years of missing metal in hundreds of billions of stars. This is another apparent gaping inconsistency with the Big Bang model.
Yeah, so in stars that are observed, let's say, in not so distant stars, of galaxies that are not so distant, that have already supposedly accumulated 10 or so billion years of aging, there should be a lot of metal. Mm-hmm. And we find many that are missing their metal content. Yet the other side of the story is also true too. They've looked for stars that have no metal. Their earliest stars are meant to be completely devoid of all metal. They're called population 3 stars.
Yes, and that's actually our next bullet on the list.
They cannot find them anywhere. They've never been observed. So they're supposedly the first stars that should be observed in the greatest distances in the universe, in the galaxies that are at the greatest cosmological distances.
Because the
should
claim
be loaded with young stars.
The claim going back to George Gamow and his associates is that the Big Bang itself would have only produced hydrogen and helium. And like you said, trace amounts of lithium. And that's in the first 20 minutes or so. You know, they deny that God could have created the universe in 6 days, yet they believe all the matter of the universe was created in the first 20 minutes of the Big Bang with no direction. It just happened. But the stars that would have formed that first generation of stars, which they call population 3 stars, which is sort of backward. You know, us amateurs, we would have called them population 1, but they call them population 3. For decades.
I think that arose historically. That's from historical development of observations of types of stars.
Exactly.
And so then the next one that they were looking for were these. They're not older stars. They're the stars that were the first stars. And in that sense, you should only find them in the most distant galaxies, because according to the Big Bang, you're looking back in time closer towards the Big Bang. And therefore, those galaxies back there should be full of population 3 stars, which are very low in metal content.
So in other words, when we look at a star through a telescope and they take the light and they look at the emission line and the absorption lines, and they see, like in a laboratory, if you burn hydrogen or burn helium and you look at the spectrum, then that element will burn especially bright at certain frequencies and dimmer at other frequencies. It sort of makes a fingerprint. So you could know what So you could know what a star is.
It's atomic physics. It's fundamental atomic physics, you know, stuff that is real science.
Yes, exactly. So when you're looking at light from our sun, you look at the spectrum and you could see the composition of the sun. How much hydrogen does it have? How much helium and so on? So when they've been looking for decades for stars that only have hydrogen and helium, and with all this effort, and this would be what they would call the smoking gun of the Big Bang, all this effort, population 3 stars are still completely missing.
That's right.
That seems to be another piece of evidence that is contrary to the expectations of the Big Bang.
Absolutely. Actually, there is one thing that there's a recent article has just come out that talks about a new theory for the Big Bang, where you don't need an origin. You have an eternal Big Bang universe. Mm. I've written a paper on this that will come out on creation.com shortly. It's called An Eternal Big Bang Universe. So the gist of it is that, as you know, the Big Bang starts in a singularity. It starts in an origin in time. And for the vast majority of Big Bang believers who are atheists, this has always been the biggest problem for them. So much so that Stephen Hawking has come up, in, I think about 2006, came up with his idea of a universe that is something like starts in a quantum fluctuation that avoids the notion of beginning in time. And he says things along the line of the universe had many histories. There is no unique history to the universe. He says that the universe had no unique beginning. Instead, it began in just about every way imaginable, and maybe some that aren't. He said, if we start from where we are now, it is obvious the current universe must select those histories that lead to these conditions. Otherwise, we simply wouldn't be here. And what he's doing is liking the origin of the universe to some non-specific, non-discrete quantum states that we might see in quantum particle physics, and so that the universe had no unique beginning. But now, just recently, a paper has been submitted for publication. It essentially eliminates the idea of a beginning altogether. So you have this infinitely long period of time of the universe just existing as a quantum potential, and then at some point it collapses, and then you get the hot Big Bang state that then the rest of the Big Bang flows from that. Yeah. And so then that gives them the product of the universe essentially creating itself without a creator, but they then don't have to solve the first cause problem of the origin in time. Yeah. And
it reminds me of all the Darwinists who, when we point out that they believe by faith that life originated from non-life, a biogenesis, they say that has nothing to do with Darwinism. It has nothing to do with evolution. We're atheistic materialists, and we don't have to explain the origin of life. And secular atheistic astronomers, they've had the same problem with the Big Bang all along. What justifies the original conditions of the Big Bang? And they've just skipped They've skipped it, and now they've gone to either a multiverse or, thank you for explaining, this quantum fluctuation, which, of course, Stephen Hawking and Lawrence Krauss, they like talking about a universe from nothing, but a quantum field is not nothing. And so they still...
No, they need a... They talk about some sort of, what do they call it, a metastable quantum state or something like that, you know. And laws of physics, too, are required in order to even calculate the history. You need to assume some laws of physics.
But if you
and
are...
And, of course, the multiverse is a good out on that one. They just simply say, we happen to be in this particular universe, and there are many, many different universes in a multiverse.
An infinite number. They're increasingly going to an infinite number of universes. So if you're a George Lucas or a Gene Roddenberry, and you're inventing worlds, well, you could invent any kind of backstory that you want to invent of how it got there.
Yeah.
And modern cosmology is almost indistinguishable from science fiction writers and Star Trek and Star Wars, because that's what they're doing. They're telling us the ancient history of the planet Hoth when it's just being made up.
Yeah, in fact, inventing languages, structure, syntax, everything, vocabulary. People even learn Klingon and speak it. It shows you the limits that people will go to exclude the notion of a creator God. We should bring this down to an important point here, because people like William Lane Craig, Hugh Ross, these are Christian apologists who use the idea of Big Bang origin in time in the initial Big Bang as their apologetic defense of Genesis.
Yes.
And the reason they're using it is because they accept without question all of what the Big Bang theorist says. But what do they do now? What if this new idea of this eternal Big Bang universe takes hold? Are they going to continue down that track and say, yeah, we believe everything that comes out of science? They've already shot themselves in the foot because they're using that as their apologetic.
Dr. Hartnett, I'd like to share with you two claims made to me from a leading scientist who is an anti-Darwinist old earther, part of the intelligent design movement. I spoke with him about the Big Bang in person on the West Coast, and then we followed up with a one-hour, one-on-one phone call. And so I don't want to give his name because they were private conversations. But here's what he claimed. I argued that if the Big Bang turns out to be false, then we are using a bad argument for the existence of God. We shouldn't do it. He disagreed with that. He disagreed with that, which I couldn't even comprehend how anyone could disagree with that. If the Big Bang is false, then we're hurting ourselves by using it as an argument for God. Well, he disagreed with that.
Absolutely.
Right.
I was going to say, my own story is that before I became a Christian, I subscribed to the steady state theory. This was in 1968. In 1965, the cosmic microwave background radiation had already been discovered. So the Big Bang theory was rapidly gaining popularity and favor over the steady state theory, which was like an eternal universe. Mm-hmm. I chose to believe the steady state theory because I didn't want an origin in time. Mm. Then I didn't need a creator in my universe.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so that was my philosophical worldview back then.
So if
and this is the problem.
And a lot of astronomers don't like the Big Bang because it sounds too much like Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But then this scientist went on to make two other points. He said, well, the Big Bang itself cannot be falsified in any way because it only claims that the universe had a beginning and that it expanded. That's all it claims. And John, that just threw me for a loop to talk to a scientist who said that his claim cannot be falsified.
Well, in some sense, he's right, because it depends on what test you perform, you know.
Well, what if you use the test that the Big Bang proponents themselves offer? Like, for example, looking at the furthest galaxies, they should be infant galaxies. That's one test.
Yeah, that's right. So that test, we can say, yes, it falsifies the Big Bang. But if he's speaking about the Big Bang as a worldview, as a paradigm,
right,
then in that sense, just like Darwinian evolution, they cannot be falsified because they're too rubbery. They'll just simply say, we were wrong there. The science is correcting itself and we need to fix that part of it. But the paradigm doesn't change. And this is the problem, you know, of the cosmology, or really we're talking about cosmogony, about the origin of the universe. Okay, the next bullet, amassing evidence suggests the universe may have a center. Okay, this topic is quite a big topic, but so let's try and sort of boil this down into easy concepts. The idea of the universe having a center and therefore also an edge is completely abhorrent in modern Big Bang cosmology. In modern cosmology of any kind, in steady state, any type of modern atheistic cosmology. And the reason is, of course, quite obvious that if there's a center, then it implies a privileged position and therefore a creator and so on. But it's also acknowledged by leading physicists like Feynman, for example, that we choose to believe this statement. And this statement of it is really what's in the cosmological principle, that we live in a part of the universe that's nothing special, because there aren't any special privileged locations in the universe.
Right.
From a creationist point of view, the universe could have a center and an edge because we believe in a creator, and we could also believe that he placed our galaxy somewhere near the center of not even necessarily the whole universe, but certainly
the
universe we can see around us,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that we can see God's glory and see his creation and that we're at the center of his focus and things like this.
Right.
So there's two different angles that you could come at this from. But one important thing to understand is that the standard model, the Friedman-Lemaître-Robinson-Walker model upon which the standard Big Bang cold dark matter cosmology is based, requires the assumption of no center and no edge. That's the basis of the cosmological principle.
Mm.
And you can only solve the equations to get the equation that they apply to the universe with that assumption.
Dr. Hartnett, you mentioned Richard Feynman. I love his writing. He did say that this assumption of uniformity of the universe reflects a prejudice, and he says we cling to it to avoid embarrassment. And in fact, similar statements, maybe not as colorful, are made by Stephen Hawking and George Ellis and so many cosmologists, who they admit that it requires philosophy for us to hold to a cosmological principle and say that the universe is the same in every direction from every vantage point and that it has no center and no edge. They don't have scientific proof of that. What they have is a philosophy.
Absolutely. I agree. And also, if we were to say that the universe does have a center, and even if we could show evidence that is consistent with our galaxy being located somewhere near that center, none of this would have anything to do with absolute geocentrism, this idea that
right.
the Earth is stationary and the rest of the universe is rotating around it.
Yes.
It would have nothing to do with that.
Yes, and Dr. Hartnett, you wrote an article. You were in a movie called The Principle, which claims that the universe orbits around the Earth once every 24 hours. And you've written against that very eloquently at realscienceradio.com/geocentrism. We have a rebuttal to that film, and I've met the producer and we've screened the film. So it's right. It has nothing. This galactocentrism has nothing to do with geocentrism.
Nothing. And so I have, over the last several years, I have looked at large-scale galaxy surveys and sort of done stamp collecting, and essentially looked at their redshifts, piled up distributions of redshifts, and tried to see if we could determine if there's concentric structure there. Now, we do see concentric structure in redshift space. And this is the bit that a lot of people can't get their heads around. We're not really looking at real space.
Mm.
We have to know what causes redshift. And there are a number of possible mechanisms that are causing it when we look at the redshifts of galaxies. They have local motion within clusters, and that can cause what's known as a Doppler effect, which is just like in the police radar gun or in the weather radar.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shift in the wavelength of the light due to motion. They also can have motion within clusters and within their filaments and walls and have bulk motion in that sense. But then there's this idea of redshift as a distance measure. This is the Hubble law, or the extrapolation of the Hubble law in the large scale universe. If you were to use that as a measure of distance, it does appear like we're at the center of, or near the center of, some large structure of millions of galaxies. But we have to be very careful about what that means, because of this other problem is we can't see all the galaxies out there. We're limited. As we look further and further out, we see less and less galaxies. This is just due to extinction, due to, you know, not enough photons being received in our telescope. So we then have to model the universe. And this is the problem of cosmic variance. We can't test the universe because we don't have a whole pile of other universes to test it against.
So all we can do is model what we think a typical universe should look like in a supercomputer or something like that. I have continued to look into this, investigate this, and working with Jason Lyle and Jake Hebert at the Institute of Creation Research, we are continuing an analysis of the large-scale structure. And I don't wish to really foreshadow the results of that analysis.
Sure.
But it's starting to look like it's a redshift space effect for sure, but it may not mean that we can say anything about real space galactocentricity, if I can use that word. And that's what we have to be careful about.
And as we said earlier, as I suggest that the full story on redshift appears to not be known yet.
Yes.
So I'll take that to heart and realize when we're seeing quantized redshift, that's not necessarily an actual preferred distance of galaxies.
That's right. Even if we were able, now you can rule things out. So as I said earlier, we're not like in a laboratory, but we can look at the observational evidence and we can rule out things, but we can't always be so certain about what we even rule out. And this is this problem of cosmic variance. We say, if the universe is the same locally, same at greater distance as we can see locally, then we can make a conclusion. But there's a big assumption in there. And that's the part, that's why it's unknown, because we may never be able to see that. And so there's always that uncertainty. However, even if this analysis were to show that there is no specially biased data that suggests that we're somewhere near the center of some giant set of galaxies arrayed on, you know, like I use the analogy, like an onion, the shells of an onion.
Right.
Even if we were able to rule that out, that still doesn't prove that we're not near the center of the universe. Because even if the distribution of galaxies was just this cosmic web-like structure, God could still have placed our galaxy somewhere near the center of his created universe.
Right.
Just that we can't prove it. But
sure.
That doesn't mean that it's not a possibility.
And it's not proved that there is no center. That's a philosophical claim, yet it's almost enforced in a ruthless manner through our universities.
And absolutely.
It makes it difficult to assess the scientific data, the observations, in a more neutral way when you have to adhere to some dogma. And it's called dogma, by the way, by, for example, Tipler in his classic book, John Barrow and Frank Tipler, in their Anthropic Cosmological Principle text. They call it 20th century dogma that there is no center.
I'll just say, Bob, because of that dogma, it has led to crazy conclusions in the model, which include dark matter, dark energy, and these type of things, because they have to explain the universe somehow and yet maintain the dogma, because they don't want to let go of that.
And hundreds of relevantly degreed scientists have published a paper, cosmologystatement.com. You could find the paper at .com. And they've said that there's an increasing number of imaginary factors that the Big Bang is resting upon. And so you could tweak them any way you want to explain any data you want. So it's quite the challenge for them to maintain credibility with the way their theory is morphing. Dr. Hartnett, we have very little time left. Could I maybe ask you real quickly about a couple items?
Yep.
Are you familiar with the issue of the sun's angular momentum, in that if the solar system condensed from a spinning nebula, then the sun should be spinning much, much faster, but in fact, it would have lost 99% of its angular momentum if the secular story is true of how the solar system formed?
That's right. Just like a spinning skater, as the mass condensed down into the central star, which comprises 99% of the mass of the solar system. greater than that.
It should have 99% of the spin, but it only has 1%. So that's like a really big, that's a big observation that something's wrong with the nebula hypothesis.
You have a real problem of how to get rid of all that angular momentum. It's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, and that appears to be consistent with other exoplanets also.
Yeah.
Dr. Hartnett, have you followed the development with supernovas and the claim that that's where all the heavy elements were formed, and then as they exploded, that they distributed those heavy elements throughout the galaxies, except now that's being retracted in a big way in the journals Nature and Astronomy and Astrophysics, and even by the National Science Foundation, where they're saying we have to figure out where the heavy elements come from, because they obviously didn't come from supernovas.
They can't build them above iron or something like that.
And when they look at the spectrum of supernovas, they're not finding all these heavier elements. So now they're thinking, well, maybe they were formed in neutron stars and they get distributed in neutron star mergers and when a black hole crashes into a neutron star.
Yeah, so they have another problem, right? Because we have all these heavy elements like uranium and gold and all this found on Earth, and yet they say all the elements that we have in our solar system came from prior supernova distributed through the universe.
And if that were true, and or even if it were true from neutron stars and black hole mergers, then you'd expect to find a somewhat homogeneous distribution of these heavy elements in the Earth and also in our solar system, but you don't. And it doesn't look like everything was made out of a well-mixed batch of elements.
There are many of these kind of anomalies, I think. Isotope ratios even, you know, different to isotopic numbers of different of some of these elements. Mm. They seem to be mismatched between the Earth and the other planets, for example.
And the Earth
Not
and the Moon.
Not just the element itself, but the actual isotope of the element.
And the Earth and the Moon and the Earth and the Sun and so on.
Yeah.
A lot of anomalies.
Yeah, exactly.
And in fact, it's mostly anomalies. Dr. Hartnett, we've been interviewing physicist Dr. John Hartnett from Australia. He's a professor at the University of Adelaide School of Physical Sciences. So my last question to you, Dr. Hartnett, I've done this long enough that I know that when an amateur weighs in on a scientific controversy, there's plenty of opportunity to blunder and to make obvious mistakes. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church, and I'm a radio talk show host of 24 years. When you look at the evidence that we list here, our evidence against the Big Bang, does it look sloppy or does it look like we're doing our homework?
Oh, no. It looks very good, very deep, and you've certainly done a lot of research here.
Well, that's encouraging, Dr. Hartnett. We don't want to provide bad arguments for the existence of the Creator God. We want to be responsible and have credibility. So what an honor to have you come in and evaluate some of our list here. Thank you very much, Dr. Hartnett.
You're welcome.
All right.
Very glad to be on your radio show.
Well, it's a thrill for us. That was Dr. John Hartnett, again, physicist from Australia, and I'd say one of the world's most successful physicists because of his scores of papers published, and how many physicists have invented a clock that's used around the world to calibrate atomic clocks. That's quite an accomplishment in and of itself. So when people Google Big Bang predictions, that is not a creationist term. That's a secular science term. Big Bang predictions. Of over a million web pages, our Real Science Radio article on Big Bang predictions is usually in the top three. We are thrilled with that. We might be headed to number one. In fact, usually we're number two, only beat by Wikipedia. So if people continue to Google Big Bang predictions and click on our article, Real Science Radio's article at kgov.com, or if people link to our article on Big Bang predictions, increasingly students scientists around the world will get the accurate account of history, that the predictions that are claimed to support the Big Bang, that they do not, that they undermine the validity of the Big Bang. That's the actual history of the actual record of scientific observation. So this is Bob Benyart for Fred Williams in Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.